Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're going to take you on a little Asian excursion for the most part.
An Asian excursion, but in a place you wouldn't not necessarily expect, and certainly not in Asia. So we've collected three rather splendid people who have rather splendid Asian restaurants. Two of them in London, one of them in Manchester. We thought we'd bring them to you all together.
And they're all fun.
Yeah, they're all a fun environment, and they're people who really have a sense of achievement. And when you listen to their interview, you'll understand why.
Now, our first guest is, I would say, in his own right, an absolute character.
He is. No question. Absolutely no question about it. The funny part about it is his restaurant, House of Ho, is in London. But he's most well known for his TV programs about food, which air in Asia.
In Thailand.
We're not quite sure we understand how Bobby Chin keeps on all the moving parts together.
Yeah.
But he certainly succeeds in doing that, and I think a somewhat frenetic personality, which you'll hear in this upcoming interview, probably has something to do with it.
Bobby Chin, we had so much fun at your Soho restaurant called House of Ho in London. It was a whole big evening out for us.
Yes, I'm here.
You were complicated. Thank you. You are a complicated man and hard to pin down.
I know.
Your background's so complicated. Explain it.
I'm half Egyptian, half Chinese, born in New Zealand, educated in England from San Francisco, but I've been living outside of the United States for most of my life. I was educated in Cairo, in England, Folkestone, Somerset, and I did my college in both the United States and in England, where I graduated with a BA in finance and economics. And then just kind of like, I've been doing just what I do, just constantly learning and growing and trying to find things that I enjoy doing. So,
when you do restaurants, do you have other restaurants besides House of Ho?
I do. I used to have a restaurant in Hanoi, which was what kind of like got me to television. It was, I went to Vietnam in 1993-94 and then moved there in 1996, and I wanted to go learn Vietnamese food. I figured that that would be the new food because of the U.S. embargo after the war, people didn't really know Vietnam other than it was a war. They don't know anything about the food, the culture, the history, nothing. And that's not just in the United States, that's all over the world. We're going to recognize that embargo.
Hanoi is recognized as one of the major food capitals now.
Yeah, and it's an incredible food. And you read any cookbook and I'll tell you the French and the Chinese, and it's uniquely different from the rest of Southeast Asian cuisine, but there's like a missing link somewhere. Why is their food so light? Why do they not saute, say, in oil, and they use stock or water? Where does that all come from? And no one's kind of like really pinpointed it, because the country's been at war for thousands of years, so it wasn't like anyone was figuring out a cookbook. No one knows who actually wrote the national dish, who invented the national dish of pho. Right? It's like, shouldn't that be documented? But nobody knows this stuff. And so I went there kind of like, how do I learn the food? I don't speak Vietnamese. I ended up hanging out with a professor and ended up running the Ford Foundation Arts and Culture, you know, PhD kind of guy. I'm like, finally PhD people that know something about the food, writing their dissertations on street food or food in Vietnam. And, you know, it's incredible. I think one of the missing links would be the Cham people. Because the Cham was still around, and but no one's actually associated, because, you know, you always talk about Bang Xiao, the crispy crepe, as a crispy crepe, like the French had something to do with it.
But it's not.
Where did the crepe and the turmeric come from, and the coconut milk, and those flavors? It's very complex, and it's very interesting.
Well, of course, the whole part of the world, I mean, we just got the most enormous tome on Thailand and Thai cooking. Boy, is that complicated.
Yeah, but imagine Thai food without the chili. I mean, the chili only arrived in the 16th century.
Uh-huh.
No, I mean, that's another interesting.
The Portuguese, the Portuguese were everywhere. So anyhow, back to your restaurant and your television. Tell us what you do on TV. You're a superstar, aren't you?
I don't get paid like one. They treat me very nicely. I started by traveling in a TV show called World Cafe Asia, which was entering a city and experiencing a film to be like one day, where it takes you about 5 days to film it. They're half-hour shows, and I cook a breakfast, a lunch, and a dinner. And then the fast track to understanding a culture is generally food, and you can find those in wet markets all over Asia. And I'd go visit the wet markets and then meet a couple of, like, influential chefs or go iconic dishes from the country, art galleries, music, you name it. And then, you know, they gave me a second season. And then the third season, being half Egyptian, and I could have gone anywhere in the world, I've always felt, you know, the Arabs have really bad PR. Every time you see them on television, they're upset about something, or, you know, it's just not a really great image. And I figured that I could go do a show over there because of my heritage. So I can speak Arabic and I can, off camera make people feel a bit more relaxed and we get a little fun into it. So The third season we did, they turn into 1-hour shows. I mean, the first season, they're installations, I guess, now, because I don't know when I film them, but I live in Sicily, Peru, Portugal, Zanzibar, and get to travel all over the world. And that's been an incredible experience because when you're cooking, you only want to cook to make people happy. You want to, you know, share and entertain. And to go cook with icons like Toshiro, you know, that was Nobu's mentor, who's still cooking and doing incredible food in Peru. To meet these great chefs.
Where is he in Peru?
He's in Lima.
I mean, what's his restaurant?
Toshiro.
Well, okay. We didn't go there.
Somehow we missed that one. We spent 9 days in Peru last September.
Is it a Nikkei?
It's
Peruvian Japanese fusion.
It was Japanese fusion, but just at a level that you just, when you take a bite, you start laughing. He's a guy that takes like lime. And then, you know, the tiger milk, you know,
yeah,
the tiger milk
or
the protein
from.
Well, he creates his own tiger milk by using lemon, salt, and garlic. And supposedly, if you just run your blender for exactly 30 minutes, I think it's 30 minutes, 30 minutes, or 30, the whole thing turns white and stays white. And then you have this very wonderful, you know, the perfect balance of lime. And, you know, their limes are just incredible.
Yeah.
The lime with the salt and the garlic. And then he pairs it with this thing they call a Viagra it's a root vegetable.
Maca. Yeah, I know.
Maca. And then the chili. And then the whole thing is assembled together. It's garnished with avocado and tobiko. And you taste it. And it's like, there's no yardstick. There is nothing that is I've ever put in my mouth that tasted like that. That was fresh, clean, a little spicy, a hint of spice with incredible textures and contrast that you just say. And then the guy's making food like this nonstop. Incredible.
Bobby, are there media streams available for your program anywhere?
I don't know.
You don't know?
My mother gets upset with me because I don't know what channel it's like. I don't know what channel it's on. Sometimes the Food Network has it in the Middle East. It's out there. It's World Cafe now.
World Cafe, okay.
Yeah. World Cafe, yeah.
Everybody, let's for World Cafe.
Well, hold on a second. Let's come back. Let's not forget the reason we're doing the interview is about your restaurant. And starting a restaurant in London must be quite an adventure.
Yeah, it's a journey as well. It took about 8 years. I met a banker on a diving boat in Irian Jaya, which has incredible diving. And he was the guy that helped finance and roll out Carluccio's. And so, you know, I was doing, you know, my restaurant was getting very popular in Hanoi. I mean, there's nowhere to really eat in those days. I kind of like introduced fine dining. There was no dessert. Dessert was cut fruit. You know, it was either the hotel and then there was me. And they wouldn't find many people like me in the capital. And from there, the restaurant got quite popular, and I passed through London, and he says, you should come and open in London. And I was like, yeah, the weather's terrible, you know, it's expensive. I've got a great quality of life. I mean, it's $10 for a massage for an hour, okay, in Vietnam. I have a lifestyle, and I never did anything for money. The whole venture into food was about finding something that I love doing, and so money was secondary. And so I ignored it for many years, and then the TV show came, and then all of a sudden my popularity rose across Asia in a manner that quite strange to receive fame at such I'm 40, you know, I mean, maybe when I was like 18 years old, I could get into it, but at 40, you know, I've been treated like crap most of my life, so I'm not really embracing the idea of fame. And then, to me, it was like, wait a sec, but I've been working in Vietnam, I haven't really made much money, I get paid in dong, and I don't know if you know, but it's like a 2.2 million dong to $100, right? So my dongs don't really add up too much here. So I figured I'd come out here and do something with him. And he said, I'll find you a location, and I'll get you investors, and you do something here, and let's try something. That took 8 years. And it was like 8 years, just one day. He says, I need you to come here immediately. When's the quickest you can come out? I said, in 2 weeks. He says, okay, come out in 2 weeks. I got a location. It's a funky space, but it's the birthplace of British rock and roll and the modern pop industry. It's, you know, they had the brothels upstairs. And I looked at it, and I was like, a restaurant in Soho? I'm laughing. I was like, that's iconic. So I had to cook for the investors and explain what Vietnamese food was. And why no one knows it, and what makes it unique. I mean, it's healthy, it's gluten-free, it's low-fat, it's easy to make, it's contrasting flavors, textures, heat, temperatures, and it's fresh, and there's nothing like it. And then I'd exemplify how easy it was to make, and then presented a four-course, or four dishes, four or five dishes, And they said, okay, who wants to invest? And literally all the people in the room just raised their hands and said, done. It was so much easier than doing it in Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam was a little bit difficult.
Now, you've been open for how long now, Bobby?
Now it's 4 months. 5 months, just coming up to 5 months. We opened on January 6th this year.
It's really amazing how magnificently the restaurant performs after that shorter period of time. You must pinch yourself and say, how did I make this happen?
I made it happen through a fear. Fear is a colossal motivator for me. A fear of failure, I think. What I did do, because there's no Vietnamese in the kitchen, so it's very difficult to impart what food should taste like to a culture that doesn't eat that food or know that food.
Right.
And so, and I felt the same way about introducing Western food to Vietnam. I mean, in Vietnam I was doing Western fusion and some Vietnamese dishes because no one would pay me to do Vietnamese dishes. But when I did make Vietnamese dishes, I'd ask the Vietnamese, like, oh, you understand our palate. And to basically understand that became formulaic. And I look at Japanese food like that. I look at Japanese food as very formulaic. When you talk to Japanese, or you look at a Japanese cookbook, the foundations are like mirin, sake, soy. And then it's like 1-1-1, tablespoon, equal ratios, or 2-1-1. And I started looking at recipes like that. And then I said, how do you do that with Vietnamese food? And I did that with Vietnamese food, in essence, by looking at the caramel sauce. So caramel sauce to me is 1 tablespoon of palm sugar to 1 tablespoon of fish sauce to 1 tablespoon of shallot oil. You could use pork, you could use lard, but I didn't see the point of that, just to kind of like thicken it.
You're not insisting that this all be authentic, are you? It's sort of modern takes, right, on your menu.
Some of it is modern. I mean, the thing is that I just present it differently. Like, say, for example, there's the duck a la banana, which is an inspiration from the movie 4 Weddings and a Funeral, where at the eulogy, he says he invented duck a la banana. And I laughed out loud in the movie theater, and I just thought it was the funniest thing I've heard. And I was like, I want to make duck a la banana. How does one make duck a la banana? And then my mission was duck a la banana, banana blossoms with a spicy mint, which is a different type of herb that the Vietnamese use, and treat it exactly like the banana blossom salad with chicken, except you use duck confit. Except with duck confit, we'll marinate it in a sugar salt mixture with a puree of lemongrass. So you have a little bit of the lemongrass flavor. And then we serve it with seared duck confit and duck gizzards and then chopped peanuts and shallots. That is authentic. The only thing that's not authentic is the duck.
Yeah, somehow or other, Bobby, we missed that one. We did start out with salmon tartare, which is not exactly a traditional Vietnamese dish either, I guess.
Right. Well, there are those dishes because then I think I'm at Soho. So just down the street from me is ceviche. Now, when I went to go film in Peru, I've been making ceviche for years. But, you know, sometimes I'd cheat with it because I was an agent, and other times I wouldn't really know what it was supposed to taste like. But everywhere I ate in Peru, I ate ceviche. And so I was like, wait a sec, I can make a wicked ceviche. So the wicked ceviche comes in. A salmon tartare is the exact same thing to me. It's like, okay, what makes that tartare? The Vietnamese eat raw food. They eat raw seafood. They eat raw shrimps. They eat raw beef. Well, what makes it Vietnamese is I use soy sauce, a Vietnamese soy sauce. I use a toasted sesame oil. And, you know, instead of some chef using kikkoman or using whatever you want to use to make your tartare, my interpretation is I'm using Vietnamese ingredients. So why can't it be Vietnamese? So there is that departure.
You know, the addition of coconut jus is that took me back to our days in the South Pacific, specifically Fiji,
yeah.
Where we had that all the time because we didn't get. I mean, the tigress milk in Peru is not it's not like that with the coconut. So it
right.
Took us back to our island days.
Right. Well, you see, the thing with ceviche, the one thing, if I can be ridiculously critical for me, is that I don't like the acidity. So I would do exactly how that would be presented, remove the tiger milk, and then to lighten the sharpness is add the coconut milk, even coconut water. I've done both. And then a little bit of mangosteen juice. So you have a little bit of a slight sweetness. And the mangosteen is described by Penguin Food Dictionary as undescribably delicious.
Ah.
Okay, so there's that, I don't know how to describe that, but it's smoothed out with the coconut cream, a little bit of sweetness from the coconut water, and then a little bit of truffle oil, because this is London. This is like, you want modern? Here's modern. This is my interpretation of what we can do with it.
Well, we loved it, and we enjoyed it a lot. And we also, we took on your shaking beef, since we've had that so many times at so many Vietnamese restaurants. But you now You make yours with grass-fed beef. Now, you're moving right to the top temporal values at this point. And it's aged, dry-aged.
Right.
They're 21-day aged.
And, that's just taking a great product and just treating it in the highest regard. We hardly use oil in that dish. When that hits the wok, it's shaking, and we're shaking it back and forth to get the charred flavor. And then we finish with a little bit of the oil to get that whole smoke thing. So you got the smoke and the char. It's just, I don't know. A lot of the dishes, when I think about the creations of them, are just things that you've seen. And you ask, why don't some people do it like this? And then if you do it, then you either fail or they say nice things about it.
Now, your restaurant has been a hit already, right? Since January, it's been a hit already. We were there on a Friday night. And we were there early, and things were jumping already, and it jumped more and more and more as the evening went on.
I don't know who all these people are. I mean, they were of every stripe, just about. I mean, there was this guy there, really sloppily dressed, overweight, in jeans with deliberate tears in them, and he was so fat his flesh was popping through the tears.
Oh, dear.
And he was coupled with his girlfriend, who was impeccably dressed in an all-white outfit, a suit. She had the pumps, she had the whole thing. And I thought for sure she was going to spill everything right down the front of her.
Well, she took the jacket off.
Yeah, but she still was all white.
She had a very elegant jacket, and she took that one off.
And then your servers come from everywhere. I mean, I told you that I found it hysterical when we didn't mention the fact that your House of Ho has a history to getting the name of it, which you could explain in a minute. But I was trying to, I thought I was the only one who knew about this. So I'm talking to our Italian waitress in Italian, explaining to her that ho meant puttana or whore in Italian.
She gets very sensitive.
They're all good looking. I'll tell you, your servers are great looking.
Yeah.
But anyhow, so you do have a funny story about the name House of Ho and how you got it. Tell us the funny story you have about how you got the name House of Ho and how hard a struggle it was to get that, pin it down.
I've always felt that in restaurants here in London, when you do a Vietnamese name, the Vietnamese is six tones, so you can never remember that you're learning a new language, Viet Trang or Viet Thieu or Huang Yen, or need to be pronounced correctly for a person to understand them. So I needed a name that would be Western as well as Vietnamese. So I thought the House of Ho would be really controversial, especially because of Ho Chi Minh. Actually, when the Vietnamese ambassador asked me, what's the name of the restaurant, I said the House of Ho. His face dropped because he's just talking about how he's going to be entertaining dignitaries and stuff. And he looks at the head of Vietnam Airlines, and they both look at me and says, "After Ho Chi Minh?" I'm like, "No, after Soho." And then the other issue was ho, as, in the urban slang, we all know what that means. So House of Ho in Soho, which used to be the red light district, would be very, very naughty. And then I thought ho in Chinese means good. So it's a house of good in Chinese, ho.
Oh, wow.
So it's an ambiguous name, but if graphically, House of Ho spells ho, H-O-H. And it's a name you can remember. But the problem, they all got assuming. All the men said ho is in ho. And I was like, no. I said, you see, you got a dirty mind. Not everyone has a dirty mind. And so we had a debate, not to argue. And I said, the end of the day, you'll remember the name. And that's the most important thing with a name.
You got it.
Got it.
Well, let's get the website in there, because is that the best way to get a reservation?
Well, the website, you can do the website, but also I always like talking to a human being,
because
I'm old-fashioned.
Right, so people should not, when they get to London and they're looking for a Soho adventure, they should just get the phone number.
Yeah, that'd be good. Also, you can do the website as well, but, I'm just old-fashioned. I want to talk to somebody, I only started using a credit card 9 months ago. I've been in Vietnam for so many years. It's like I had to go. I was so confused when I took the card in. I'm scared it's going to take the card and not give it back to me. And I'm withdrawing cash, and it's all, I'm old fashioned.
Right,
it's
now,
terrible.
Now your opening hours are?
I think 11:30 to 1:30. We have a license, I think up to 2 actually.
So it's 11.
We can have dancing. So, this is a license from way back when, and this was the original 2i Cafe. which is the birthplace of British rock and roll and the modern pop industry. And I think that license is still here. And so we can have dancing, we can have live music. It's a very cool license to have. It's all good.
And it's, so you can have late breakfast, you can have lunch, you can have an afternoon snack.
Yeah. Dance.
Yeah. and it's great for pre-theater. We're working with Cameron McIntosh, who's just opening up Miss Saigon. And we're on the same street.
Oh, that's
fabulous.
And it's
the 25th anniversary.
Right.
Yeah, so,
we should tell people where it is. It's on Old Compton Street,
Waldorf and Dean.
Yeah, at the Water Street end. And it's a rather forbidding black on the outside. And
yeah.
It's rather dark on the inside. But it's a laugh a minute. It's a taste sensation every minute. We dined a lot of places in London. And this is one of those where we had the most fun.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, Bobby Chin, continued good luck and success to you, and thanks for taking the time to talk.
Oh, thank you so much for talking to me. It's been both an honor and privilege to be with you today, because I know who you are.
There you go. Well, we know more about you than we knew before, and it's all been fun. And we wish you well, and next time in London, hopefully we'll meet in person.
Likewise.
And we'll be sliding from Vietnam to Japan right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up is, I think she's a dear friend at this point. I really love talking to Mimi at the restaurant, and also when she called to talk to us about the wonderful meal. I'm now in love with noodles. This place really put me on the track to loving the ramen.
Yeah, really good noodle. This is a very interesting interview. It's being done from Pittsburgh to London, but the subject is a Japanese restaurant. Mimi, welcome to On the Menu. We're so glad you were able to join us today, and we still remember the wonderful meal that we had when we visited with you a few weeks ago.
Yes. It was very nice to meet you.
And Mimi, your last name is Tokumine.
Yes.
And the restaurant's name is Shoryu. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yes, Shoryu.
Yes, but I call you the sake lady.
Yes. Hope you enjoyed the sake.
Oh, I loved it. I didn't know there were 200 varieties of sake.
Yes.
Now, let's get back to talking about the restaurant. What exactly is Shoryu? What kind of restaurant is it?
We do tonkotsu ramen, which is pork broth soup with Japanese noodles.
And it's from a specific area and culture of Japan, right?
Yes, that's from Kyushu in South Japan.
Uh-huh. And it's different from other ramens because of the richness of the broth, which I think you cook for a long, long time.
Yes, we are boiled for 12 hours, and our head chef, Kanji, spent 6 months to developing our taste of soup in Japan. And he's also in Japan at the moment to run original recipe of noodle soup as well.
Now, I mean, you have more than one location. Do you have, I didn't ever know, do you have a restaurant in Japan?
We actually don't have any restaurant in Japan, but probably our CEO, he will open one day. That's so competitive.
And how many do you have in London?
At the moment, 4 restaurants. One is takeaway, and 3 is a restaurant, ramen bar.
Well, I was so impressed because there were so many Asians eating in your restaurant, so I figured it must be pretty authentic.
Yes, very authentic, because our CEO of Japan Center, he's also from Fukuoka. Fukuoka is where tonkotsu ramen comes from.
Okay.
And head chef also, he's from Fukuoka. And then I'm also from Fukuoka as well.
Right.
So we know how it should taste like, and we're just aiming to serve proper, authentic ramen.
Well, it certainly is delicious, and I noticed that a lot of the people there, they must be regular customers because they all knew what to order and how to eat it and so forth. Where I was having trouble, and that French woman was having trouble doing the noodles with the chopsticks. But how do you generally order in a ramen restaurant? What do you order?
Do you mean what I order when I go to ramen bars?
Yes, everyone seemed to know but us. You had to guide us through the menu as to what to order.
Yes, we explain to the customers what our specialty is, and then we also ask customers if they're not keen on a pork broth soup, we also have a miso ramen and like a vegetarian ramen as well. So we need to speak to the customers if they come at the first time. But most of the customers, they know what our specialty is.
Yeah, now, it says that you can't have ramen without gyoza.
Yes.
And
it's always together.
No, you brought us some, right?
Yes.
And which was delicious. The proportions, the proportions are so enormous, though. How do people eat all of that?
How do they eat? Usually when you go to a Japanese restaurant, they serve with a plate. But in Shoryu, we do very Fukuoka style, which we use a very hot pan. So we cook the gyoza with a hot pan and then we serve.
Now, you're different from other places because of first the style of the ramen, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yes.
And then also, I mean, how many other shops have so many sakes?
Actually, we have extensive selection of sake with reasonably prices and premium sake, but I don't think there are similar places like us.
Well, now, how many different kinds do you have?
We have 120 type of sake.
And you yourself are a certified, qualified sake sommelier.
Yes, I am.
And you gave us the tasting. Run us a little bit through the different styles of sake. I think people also get confused about which ones should be drunk hot, which ones should be cold, which ones are filtered, which ones. Tell us a little bit about sake. First of all, what is sake?
Yes, the sake is it's really difficult to decide what customers drink because it's not like a wine. So I have to explain which sake would go with pork broth soup or cold items. So you basically need someone to guide it.
Well, you did that for us, and I was I was amazed at the difference.
Thank you.
I really didn't know, and I've been drinking sake at Japanese restaurants for a long time. I had no idea the range of taste.
Yes, that's why the sake won't be like a wine, I guess. Because no one can explain properly, because sake is really expensive, but you never know why it's so expensive. So
No, I would have thought I would have thought the opposite, that sake it's a wine made from rice, and surely rice isn't really a whole lot different from one kind of rice to another.
So the custom.
What makes it different?
Basically, we need to explain the different type of the sake. As you know, the sake has been used in different kind of sakes. They polish to a different percentage. So, for example, Daiginjo, the rice is being used in Daiginjo, they polish to 50%, which means rice become very, very small. That's why the breweries need to buy more rice, and they need to use more rice as well. That's why it becomes very expensive.
And now the very best sakes, are they drunk hot or cold?
Well, it depends on the sake and it depends on the food. I usually recommend customers, if they order hot meal, I would recommend hot sake. Always not cold and hot. It should be the same temperature, not temperature, same, hot or cold. If you eat cold noodle, should drink cold sake.
Right.
Yes.
Which is why you should have cold sake with sushi, right?
Yes, that's right. So when you start eating sashimi, for example, I would recommend cold sake.
Well, what about now filtered and non-filtered? I mean, one is clear, the other is cloudy.
Oh, the cloudy sake is you hot, and that's quite sweet, fruity taste. So I usually recommend customers to drink before you really start eating food. Like an aperitif. Yes, that's right.
Right.
Otherwise, you can't enjoy the savory food.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe after a meal.
Well, I mean, we just had a wonderful time.
Thank you.
Why all of a sudden? It's not just London. It's all over the U.S., everywhere. People are going nuts for ramen.
Yes, that's
Why?
A good question. I think, especially in London, when the Asian chain restaurant, which is called, I think you know, Wagamama.
Oh, yeah, Wagamama.
Yeah, Wagamama, when they become popular, you know, long time ago, we see, the people want more than sushi.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So, our chairman just noticed that probably next one would be the noodles.
Uh-huh.
Because people now can eat anything they like.
I see.
Not like before. Because England, no many restaurants before. Just people just noticed that, you know, they're not satisfied only sushi and tempura.
Uh-huh.
So then Wagamama opened a noodle restaurant that people just like to eat it. Then our chairman noticed we should do this business. But Wagamama is not authentic. So we just wanted to show how good noodles can be. It's so delicious. And even though it's pork broth soup, people can take it.
Right.
So we just wanted to bring it to the UK to become famous.
Well, now, in Japan, there's a different type of restaurant for every type of food. So you go to a restaurant for what you want to eat.
Yes, that's right. It depends on what you want to eat.
Uh-huh. And are ramen restaurants in Japan as popular as they are in London?
Very popular. Very, very, very popular.
Well, they sure taste, it tastes good.
But, very good.
But you probably...
Really good.
You don't know what we all went to college eating. Instant ramen. Have you ever seen that?
Ah.
Did you ever see it?
It's so different.
Oh, my God.
It's so popular, honestly. Maybe it's like a puff.
It's what?
It's like a puff.
Puff.
You can, yes.
Yeah.
It's ramen bars everywhere in Japan.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Well, I think I have the secret, really. And I think you have the secret, but you're not letting on. A hot bowl of ramen with the wonderful 12-hour broth is just the thing to deal with London's gloomy, cold weather.
Yeah, that's true.
So I'm wondering if perhaps the weather where it comes from in Japan is the same.
Right, yes.
Well, I think I should add that the atmosphere of your restaurant, the one that we were in, was so cheerful because everybody seemed very happy, comfortable, and at home with their ramen.
Oh, thank you very much.
And everybody socialized. I mean, it was a social event. And, of course, we benefited from having your tutelage, which was, we really can't thank you enough for that because it made it a very special experience for us.
Oh, thank you very much. So glad you enjoyed.
Thank you, and thank you so much for getting back in touch with us today so that we're able to bring you to the On the Menu program. Thank you so much, and we'll see you again next time we're in London, I'm sure.
Yes, please.
Oh, yes,
I'm looking forward to seeing you soon.
Yes, it's a good motivation for us to get there soon. Thank you very much. Arigato.
Thank you very much. Arigato gozaimasu. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, and it's Chinese from England right after the break.
What a small world it is.
Very small world, then.
Yes. I say that over and over again, but this is truly interesting. We're talking to Helen C., whose twin sister, Lisa, developed recipes and wrote this cookbook for their restaurant in, of all places, Manchester, England. And the book is called Sweet Mandarin Cookbook, Classic and Contemporary Chinese Recipes with Gluten and Dairy-Free Variations, which is probably one of its major distinctions, is it not, Helen?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We're very passionate about gluten-free and dairy-free.
Yes, well, I mean, that's the way to go right now. I mean, you could be. Do you find yourself in an odd spot in Manchester? I've been to Manchester.
Well, I was born and bred in Manchester, and it's the only place that I know as home, so I don't consider it odd at all.
Uh-huh.
And actually, in Manchester, we do have about 100,000 Chinese people here as well.
Yeah,
so it's quite cosmopolitan.
It is indeed. And now, you were like the third generation Chinese chef, right?
That's right. My grandmother came over in 1959, and she opened one of the first Chinese restaurants in Manchester, where she served the dishes that we put in the cookbook to the likes of Sir Cliff Richard and the Beatles and the Shadows.
Oh my goodness! She was really a landmark chef. But then bad things happened, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, my grandmother was a legend. She single-handedly, I would say, was one of the pioneers of restaurants. Post-war Britain didn't have, you know, Chinese restaurants.
Yeah, well, apparently it says in your book that she actually opened a restaurant before there was even a Chinatown in Manchester.
Correct. That's right.
She must have been a dynamite woman, huh?
Yeah, she's a firecracker.
That was the word I was looking for.
Did you get to know her very well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I grew up with my grandmother by my side, and every Saturday we'd go shopping for groceries, and that's where I learned about our family stories and how to cook. And, you know, she is a true inspiration to me as a chef, even today.
Well, your cookbook, you really concentrate on the basics and the classics here, but modernized. But you have a story, a family story, attached to almost every one of them.
That's right. For us, these recipes are like our family heirloom. And when I was going shopping with my grandmother, you know, every bottle or packet she picked up unraveled another chapter in her life. And we wanted to share our family stories with the readers of this cookbook, because really food is such a, you know, an emotional tie. When you enjoy a meal, it takes you back to that very happy memory.
Uh-huh.
Or when you're cooking that particular dish, you remember the people that you cooked it with. And that's what we wanted to evoke in this cookbook.
Well, I mean,
it's really funny. If I can just inject something here, it's really funny. I remember the upsurge of Chinese restaurants happening in the early to mid-1950s, when I was living in Huddersfield. But the thing about them that was unique and unusual wasn't that they served Chinese food. In fact, they served quite the opposite. They served essentially Occidental food, meat and three veg, and the difference was they were a lot less expensive.
Yeah.
But your grandmother's restaurant was entirely different. Was a real Chinese restaurant.
It's a real Chinese restaurant, but I think she also did things like steak and chips.
Okay, so she did that too, right? If you wanted steak and chips, you could have that too, huh?
Yeah, definitely. I think it takes time for a nation to acclimatize to new cuisine, and she certainly tantalized the taste buds of the locals with her restaurant. Her Lily Quartz curry, which is one of the best sellers in our restaurant, that was something that the locals had never tried before in their whole life, and it was so spiced, the aroma was really, really exciting flavors. And even, you know, like the sweet and sour chicken that's in the book.
Uh-huh.
There's an argument saying, is this Anglo-sized Chinese cuisine? But actually, when I did my research, there is actually a dish in China called sour sweet pork. So basically the balance is more vinegary, but actually the sweet and sour element is very much a Chinese kind of classic cuisine. And we just adapted it to chicken because it's a leaner meat, because we're into healthy cooking.
Now, the interesting thing is you have the pork dish with it's red something or other that supposedly Chairman Mao ate every day. And
yeah.
We were trying to remember another Chinese restaurant we were at somewhere in the rest of the world. And they told us that this dish was on their menu, and they said the same thing as you did, that this is something that Chairman Mao ate. Now what's that called?
Chairman
the
Mao.
Chairman Mao's
red chicken.
Red cooked pork.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a lovely, rich broth. You know, very, very deep in flavour, infused with aniseed. It's extremely easy to do, amazingly. The steps in the cookbook really take you through very, very gently and quite simply, but you create this absolutely amazing dish that's so different and would really wow at dinner parties. And the beauty is, because it's in a kind of simmering broth, say the guests are late, that's even better for the dish because the pork will continue to absorb the flavours. It won't go dry.
Do you make it today and serve it tomorrow?
You can make it today and serve it tomorrow, or you can make it today and serve it tonight.
Okay, so you can do both.
But
the guests don't have to be on time.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, tell me this. When your grandmother got there in Manchester, it must have been hard getting the right ingredients.
It was extremely hard in the 1950s to get anything close to what Chinese ingredients were in Hong Kong or China.
So what did you do?
In actual fact, the nearest port was Liverpool, which was a good hour away from Manchester, where she was located. And to carry sacks of 20 kg bags of rice, practically impossible. So she had to actually learn how to drive. She bought herself an old banger, which was a red car, because red is signifies luck in Chinese.
Right.
She didn't drive very well. She actually drove on the wrong side of the roundabout and got stopped by the policeman. She actually let her go because he said he loved the food. And she drove that old banger all the way to Liverpool to pick up the stock, which is what she used in the restaurant. So every Sunday they closed to go and restock for the vegetables, for the spices, for the rice, for the noodles. And it was quite a, you know, culinary adventure in those days.
Oh, sure. Right. Now, I've enjoyed your section on soup particularly. I mean, some of these are just absolutely wonderful, these recipes.
Tell me again about the chicken foot soup.
Oh, yeah, no, see, I have had trouble with my knees, and I said to Peter, I'm going to have to make this chicken feet soup.
Yeah.
And I was all set. You know, he said, where are you going to get them? And I said, we have plenty of Asian markets. I can get them. And then I read your tip. And you said, it's not so bad once you get past the toenails. And then I said, I don't think I can do that.
We've got to give the pre-warning, don't we? We have to be.
Well, no, we did have duck feet. We did have duck
yeah,
feet.
Yeah, Peter says his favorite message on voicemail was a Chinese restaurateur who I knew pretty well. Called and left the message, Anne's duck feet are ready.
The message was actually, I have duck feet. This is Jennifer. I have duck feet for Anne.
Lucky Anne.
So I went to get them, and we ate them, and they were pretty good.
They were duck feet are good, yeah.
Maybe they didn't have as much toenail in them.
More like a web.
Now, you've been doing some things that made you famous in your own right. We've been talking about your grandmother, but tell us the story of how you got to meet Gordon Ramsay and he became such a big fan.
Well, myself and my two sisters opened a restaurant in 2004 called Sweet Mandarin in Manchester. And by opening it, we became the third generation of women restaurateurs, following in the footsteps of my grandmother and mother. In 2009, we were entered into a competition by our customers, unbeknownst to us, to go for the title of Best Local Chinese Restaurant with Gordon Ramsay on the F word. And when he first called up, I actually said, no, I'm not interested because I don't need Kitchen Nightmares, because that's the only show I knew he did. And our restaurant was doing fine, so we don't really need your help, thank you, sir. And then he called back again and said, oh, actually, it's a good show. It's a positive show, and you need to be in it. And that's, he explained to us it's a competition to look for the best. And so then we agreed to join in. And we actually entered it, and we won the title of Best Local Chinese Restaurant, beating 10,000 other restaurants for our accolade. And the dish that we cooked for him was my mother's dish, which is called Mabel's Clay Pot Chicken.
Oh, yes.
You can also find that in the cookbook. And it's such a delicious dish, so unique in its flavors and its offering, that we actually scored 82 out of 100 with the audience that tasted our food. We actually had to cook 50 people under pressure. These were all food critics, and Gordon Ramsay himself, and it was such a great feeling to be able to take home that trophy to my mom and say, "Mom, because of your dish, thanks to you, we've won this title, and I dedicate it to you, Mom." And most recently, actually,
isn't that marvelous?
That's a great story.
And she's a doll. And 2 days ago, we actually cooked this dish for the Premier Lee of China, also the British Prime Minister David Cameron at 10 Downing Street, and 65 of his guests. Jeez. And after the lunch that we cooked for him with this Mabel's clay pot chicken, he actually had a little meeting with my sister and I, where he said it was the best Chinese he's ever tried in the UK. And he actually finished the entire plate. I was so happy.
This was David Cameron or the President of China?
The Premier Li.
The Premier Li of China. Okay.
Well, yeah, he said
terrific.
That to us. I was floating, I was absolutely ecstatic to hear that, from the world leader, one of the most powerful men, who's tried all the Chinese food everywhere around the world, has said he loves our Chinese food, and it's just amazing. And what's the beauty about this dish is that you could actually recreate it at home, because we put it in the recipe book. We want to share how delicious, how nutritious and healthy Chinese food can be. We want to dispel the myth that Chinese food is bad for you, because we don't use any MSG. We don't use anything artificial. We want it all healthy and fresh. And this dish, to get that kind of endorsement from somebody like that, was amazing.
Oh, that must have been really thrilling, huh?
Floating, can't quite believe it's happened. And I'm happy. We actually got a photograph with him as well.
Oh, right.
If you have a website, I can send it to you and show you.
Please, absolutely, please do. We'd be delighted to put it on our website. That's really something. Now, here's a question for you. What's Gordon Ramsay really like? He doesn't have a terribly good reputation here.
He's so funny because when the camera's turned off, the swearing turns off as well.
Really?
He's actually so down to earth. He's so supportive of our business as a mentor to, young chefs trying to make it, like ourselves, in the industry. He's been an amazing help to us. And we really thank him for his support and for loving Sweet Mandarin. He's even given a quote for the book.
Yes,
Sweet Mandarin is a culinary gem. And I was just like, wow, I feel so humble to hear that from someone like him. Because he is one of the culinary greats that we aspire to look up to and to be like that. But, he's a great inspiration to us. So to get that endorsement, he's amazing. And what you see on the TV is a TV persona.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In real life, he's so nice. He's so normal. He can talk to you without any F words or, swearing.
it's funny, Helen. I was going through some old files the other day. I'm a bit of a pack rat, and it was time to throw a few things out to make room for more scraps of paper. And I discovered the bill from the time we had lunch at the original Gordon Ramsay on Royal Hospital Road. And I was able to remind ourselves how much money we spent.
It was terrible.
Painful.
But it was a wonderful restaurant. Now, I'm going to end our conversation here with a forecast. I forecast that in the not-too-distant future, you and your sisters are going to be asked to come to Peking to cook. So when you get that invitation, don't be surprised.
Okay. Thank you for that lovely forecast.
Wouldn't that be really thrilling?
Oh my goodness! If we could cook for the president of any country, it would be our honor. We actually received an MBE from the Queen this year.
Oh, fabulous!
For services to food and drink. Yeah, so it's we are dedicated to serving, cooking, and delighting our customers. They're in our restaurants, whether it's through the cookbook or whether, like you say, it's through higher appointments to, the president. It's our honour to help.
Well, we come through Manchester quite often, and I have a feeling we might have to stay an extra day.
I think so. You'd be most welcome.
Helen, thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm sure our listeners out there join us in saying, This is just a wonderful story, and it's a really feel-good story, and we're absolutely delighted that you're enjoying the success you deserve.
And it's delicious as well. Thank you
so
much,
Helen,
and hello to your sister.
Thank you.
We should tell you that we were as surprised as you listeners to discover that Helen and her sister had actually cooked for the Prime Minister of England and the Premier of China.
Yeah.
that was a very pleasant surprise, and it kind of gives you an idea that this might be kind of a good place to go.
Yeah. It's only the second set of twin chefs that we've met. The others from Languedoc?
From Languedoc, from Montpellier.
Montpellier.
The brothers whose name I can't remember just now, who have a restaurant called the La Chardin de Sens.
Yeah.
And they also have one in Paris as well. But twins cooking together is kind of unusual, I guess. But these young ladies are not only twins doing it themselves, but they're representing two previous generations doing the same thing.
Exactly.
And it's great. It's great to hear that. Now, we'd better go to a break, hadn't we?
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, so we've been wandering around the world, but in a sense not around the world, since the last three guests are all based in the United Kingdom, two in London and one in Manchester. But we're going to come much closer to home for our last segment today, because here in Pittsburgh, Justin Severino, chef proprietor of a restaurant called Cure, is really always up to something new.
He is.
And we took the opportunity to talk to him about his newest adventure.
Justin Severino, you are known to be a supporter of what I view as the contemporary chefing tradition of cooperating between different chefs. And now you're taking a really big leap with a whole series. I love the name. Explain the name and then talk a little bit about the series.
Okay, well, the name, actually, I wish I could take credit for it. A friend of mine, Quelcy from With the Grains, actually, she came up with that name, and it just made sense the minute she said it. And as far as the series goes, this series is definitely it's been a goal of mine, you know, to do these things. So the first year we were open, I had no money. You know, I opened this restaurant no one would even lend me money. And I was here every day, and I built it with a good friend of mine. You know, basically all the work that we could have done legally, we did. So when I opened, I think I literally had about $1,200 in my bank account for the business, and we opened on New Year's Eve, because it was like I knew I could get three turns out of the dining room for $90 a person or whatever it was, and we did, and that propelled us through the month of January. Part of the motivation to start collaborating was to PR myself. And leading up, before the restaurant opened, that's what I was doing. I did an event at Route 174. I did a couple of events at Notion when it was in Oakmont. I put on a couple of farm dinners on a couple of farms and in a couple of city parks. And that was kind of my way of getting the word out about Cure. And then after Cure had been opened, I got back together with, I think I got together with Dave Rascott first from Notion.
You know, I want to just insert here, because we were talking about the name of the series, and you just mentioned the name of your restaurant is Cure, and the series is called Curated, right? Now, that's clever, right? So back to your collaboration.
Yeah, so the initially it was all local chefs. I invited, I think it was Dave Rascott, Keith Fuller from Route 174, Brian Pekarsik from Spoon, Derek Stevens from 11. And then in the summer, that was in the winter and fall. Those were all events here at Cure. And that was just basically to get their clientele into my restaurant. They were friends, and I love collaborating. So the reason wasn't strictly about advertisement as much, you know. I generally love collaborating. That's how you learn. That's how I've learned. And that evolved into a summer series where we did some dinners at White Oak Farm. We did Outstanding the Field dinner, blah, blah, blah. That was the first series. And that was like, you know, that was business sense. That was a little bit of not desperation, but like, you know, at the root of who I was as a business person at that point, like that's what I knew instinctually I could do to PR myself without being able to afford PR. With that being said, though, like to take a step back, like collaboration in general is, I think, a really important part of the growth of a cook and or a chef.
You were talking before we started this the interview about the Thomas Keller presentation that you listened to, and about he was so inspirational about this collaboration and developing future talent. That's part of what you're talking about now?
Oh, yeah. His speech was, we just did an event in his honor for his 20-year anniversary at the Duquesne Club. And, his speech was great. It really, really made me feel good about what I do and why I do what I do. He basically talked about he wanted to become a cook because he realized that a group of people with the same goals can achieve exponential, better, greater goals than one person alone. And that made him want to become a chef. And when he became a chef, he realized that being a chef was about being a part of a community. It was about, having a relationship with the farmers and your customers and nourishing people and nourishing your community. And it was great because unconsciously, that's what I try to do every day. But that comes from where I've come from, which is what I was saying before. When I was a cook in California, I moved to California, work at Marina Set Bernardus Lodge. And while I was there, I was spending at least one day a week staging at Boucher. That was a restaurant that was opened by Walter Mansky. And that's what got my foot in the door at Boucher. And while I was at Boucher, I was staging at places like Manresa. And that's what got my foot in the door at Manresa. And you can do these things. You're an hourly employee. Your responsibilities are to set up and break down a station. So you can go into other kitchens and you can be a fly on the wall and you can absorb it all, and it's encouraged. I encourage stages here at Cure, and we typically always have one. I try to do it very professionally. I try to make it more than just a couple days here or a couple days there. I try to make people sign up for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks because education is awesome and that's what staging is all about. And if I can keep a sense of education in my kitchen, it's all very selfish for myself because I love it, but it creates a culture within my restaurant from the dishwasher to the hostess. This isn't just a place where you come in and you punch the clock and you do your job and you go home. There's more to it. And if you want more, then there's more here for you. And that's why I do it at this point. I'm not trying to PR the restaurant the way I was before. Honestly, this collaborative series that I have right now is all about me and what I want to do. I feel like it's been two really long, hard years of trying to establish the restaurant and gain some success. And with that being said, I think everything that I've done here at Cure is very selfish. Everything that we do here is because it's something that I love for the most part. And luckily, people like it. But I think that's where great restaurants come from.
But you have this whole series. You have five dinners, I believe, set up, and each one involves three chefs, and it's strung out over a period of time. Tell us how you selected these chefs and an idea of the span of time that all these are going to be taking place. And you even are accommodated, giving them housing, the chefs, which even expands the sense of camaraderie that you're going to create, having them visit in our town.
Yes. So last year we invited some chefs in from out of town and it was great. And then, so this year I've also traveled to do a bunch of collaborating in the last 2 years, especially in the last year. So this year what I did was I picked a chef who was a friend of mine and that I'd worked with in the past. So for instance, the first event is with Scott and Rachel Vivian and Jamie Bissonetti. So Scott and Rachel own Beast in Toronto. And Jamie owns Copa and Toro in Boston and in New York. So I was invited to Indian Chef Week in Austin, Texas, this past January that we just had, which was pretty much the most awesome collaborative event ever. It's put on by this restaurant called Foreign Domestic that's owned by Ned. What's his last name? Ned Elliott. He's coming. He's our last chef and he hasn't picked a friend, but. So it's 30 chefs and 5 nights. So it's like 4 nights of 6 to 8 course meals cooked by a different chef. And then the fifth night is all 30 chefs. It's 30 courses. It takes all day. And they put everybody up. They put all 30 chefs up. It ends up being like 50 people that they put up in these two houses. And every night they have an event planned for them. They make an effort of paying a percentage of your travel They make sure that you don't have to incur any of the cost of the food. And that's a really, really awesome thing. So long story short, I met Scott Vivian at Independent Chef Week the year that just happened. And we got along great. We ended up doing a dinner on Tuesday together. You know, he did a course and I did a course. And then we ended up hanging out all week. And then, you know, we did the last night together. And we've stayed in contact since. So, he was a guy I called. And so, this whole series of events, I invited a friend to invite a friend. So, and that was a way for me to get to work with somebody I know and then meet somebody I don't know. And the other part about it is like, I wanted to call Jamie Bissonetti. I didn't tell Scott to invite him, but I just felt a little bit awkward about calling someone that I don't actually know. Like, hey, we have all these mutual friends. Do you want to come to Pittsburgh and do an event?
Yeah, his New York restaurant's really hot, Toro, right now.
So it worked out great. You know, I felt like that was a little bit awkward. And I think, you know, from my perspective, all these guys are busy. They all either own restaurants or the executive chefs at restaurants and blindly call someone I don't know. So this is great how this worked out. So Scott and Jamie have been friends for years. Scott invited Jamie and that event is sold out and they're coming to play with us. Was it July 27th? I'm super excited about that. I think the three of us do something very similar. There's just a little bit of gluttony in all of our cuisines. It's all very Mediterranean.
That's great, gluttony. And then you jump to September, so you don't do one every month here. And did you invite Mike Isabella?
I did, yeah. Mike and I have, Mike invited me to do industry takeover night at Graffiato. I guess it was about a little bit more than a year ago. And we stayed in touch ever since. We have a bunch of, and I go to DC a lot. I've got a lot of friends in DC. So every time I go to DC, I visit him. And so yeah, and then Scott Druno, who is the executive chef at The Source, which is a Wolfgang Puck restaurant. They're really good friends. And the two of them have both won Cochon 555. And obviously, I have a knack with pigs. So we're going to do I think we're calling it the Prince of Pork. We're doing basically a whole hog dinner. And to back up, Scott Vivian and Jamie Bissonetti and I are going to do what we're calling a gluttonous Mediterranean feast.
When, do you have all these menus worked out this early?
God, no. I hate that. No, I don't expect that from these guys. I think we just, I think that that's the best thing about collaboration. It's really hard for me, and I can imagine it is the same for a lot of other chefs. It's really hard for me to write a menu for what's going to happen 4 months from now in a town that I don't live in. So we're trying to create some themes just so we can all get on the same page as far as our like creative processes go, and that's good enough for me. I think the best end result in collaboration is when you show up and some of it is actually – some of the thought processes actually happen in the space the collaboration is going on.
Next up is that I was so thrilled to see Tarver King on this. I mean, I haven't seen him for years, but I just fell in love with his food when he was really young, like in his 20s, mid-20s or something. And you were best friends with him.
Yeah, I love that guy. He's one of my favorite people on the planet. I took a job. My wife Hillary and I took a job in Middleburg and Upperville, Virginia. I was a product development manager for this large organic meat farm called Ayrshire Farm, and Hillary managed their butcher shops / grocery stores called the Home Farm Store. And I want to say about a month or less after we moved there, Tarver came into the store. Tarver had just taken a job at a place called the Goodstone Inn, which was a couple of miles away from the Home Farm Store. And it was like a godsend because we moved to this part of the world where we didn't know anyone, but it was one of the most awkward living situations of my life. I make friends really easily, and I've moved a lot. Like I move around, I get into a community, I make friends. And this is just like one of the strangest communities I've ever lived in my life. It was very, it was really, really affluent. And I felt like I was help. So Tarver and I hit it off immediately. I remember he came into the Home Farm Store I was covering with one of the butcher's days off, and he was looking for beef. And we've become really great friends ever since, but he and I've done a bunch of events together. He's been to Cure, I think, two times. I just went and did an event at his restaurant, Patamac Farm, maybe less than a month ago. And Brian Voltaggio I've been a huge fan. I've eaten at Volt a couple times. We met a couple weeks ago. He is a very, very nice guy. So I'm super excited about that. And I think I haven't necessarily talked to Brian about it, but Tarver and I, when I was at Patamac Farm, Tarver was explaining how they have about 1,000 wild pawpaw trees on their property. So we were thinking about maybe doing a papa-themed dinner, which I think would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, having lived in Indiana, it's not an exotic fruit for me, pawpaw cheese, but I understand. It's more nostalgic for me than anything. So, and then you have, after that, you have George Sabatino, you have Mike Solomonoff from Zahab in Philadelphia, and then you haven't finished yet. Ned Elliott from Foreign and Domestic in Austin hasn't picked a friend yet. Now, in general, these dinners are $135 per person, inclusive of beverages, tax, and gratuity. And what everybody should do is call this phone number.
The phone number is 412-252-2595. That price is not necessarily going to be what is the price for all of the events. The one thing that I've very much encouraged is for all of the chefs to have their input on the style of the event. So, for instance, the Mike Solomonov and George Sabatino. Mike's a good friend of mine, too. So last year when Mike came to Pittsburgh and did an event with me at White Oak Farm, Mike does really simple, like Israeli small plates at his restaurant. And so what we've decided to do is, for that event, we're going to take reservations in the restaurant. So we're going to, instead of doing one seating, we're going to take about 75 reservations, you know, just like a normal night of service. And each chef is going to create five small plates that have like five or less ingredients on each plate. And we're just kind of bombard each table with 15 small plates of food. So with that being said, I don't really know what the style of the Tarver King and Voltaggio event's going to be, or the Ned Elliott event.
Give us a clue. First of all, these are going to sell out real fast. What is the most efficient way of tracking them and getting in on them, making your reservation? Are you going to have an ongoing update on your website or what? And give us your website.
So we have an event link at curepittsburgh.com, and we are allowing ticket sales 2 months in advance of every event. And you're just going to have to call Cure at 412-252-2595. You can also go to our website and request a reservation, and you'll hear back from Jennifer, our lovely manager.
Well, it sounds exciting. I think it's going to shake up the dining scene in Pittsburgh a lot. And I think that not just you and your customers, but all of the chefs in Pittsburgh are going to have a ball with this, getting to meet all these people. And I hope you get some ancillary events. You can bring them all to my house for dinner.
Yeah, that's one of the other things we want. I want to make sure that every event there's going to be a gathering for the chefs in Pittsburgh to come and, you know, have some drinks and have some snacks and meet these guys. I think it's really important. I think that's what great chefs in San Francisco to do. They work together, and that's why that city is an amazing food city. They hold each other up. And I think all the players in the game here in Pittsburgh are all great people, and I think we all are trying to do that in our own little way. So really excited to see what happens.
Thanks so much for venturing in this series. Again, it's curated, and it's at Cure Pittsburgh, and the host is Chef Justin Severino. Thanks from all of us, I should say. And I'm looking forward to it.
And that's it for today's program. We hope you'll join us same time, same place next week. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.